Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Jack Blum, a veteran of U.S. Senate investigations who uncovered the Lockheed bribery scandal, the BCCI bank scandal, and the CIA Contra cocaine connection. A Washington lawyer who is an expert on white-collar crime and international tax evasion, he spent 14 years as a staff attorney with the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and joins us to discuss the scandal swirling around Trump and an administration that is breaking all prior historical records in Washington in terms of corruption, compromise, chicanery, and sleaze. As the law closes in on Trump from several directions, with his former campaign manager convicted, along with his deputy campaign chairman pleading guilty, and his former national security advisor awaiting sentencing, together with a former campaign advisor and his personal lawyer and fixer pleading guilty and implicating Trump as a co-conspirator, we will assess what it will take to end this criminal regime looting the country and weakening its standing in the world. But while a majority of Americans feel some relief that justice is on the way, a third of the country inside the alternative universe of Trump's base remain unaware of what is happening as Fox News ignores what happened on Wednesday and blares out headlines about a young woman missing in Iowa they allege was murdered by an undocumented immigrant whose lawyers claim he is in the country legally. Then we get an update on the comprehensive timeline of the Trump-Russia story at investigaterussia.org and examine how the latest convictions of Manafort and Cohen's guilty plea and apparent cooperation with prosecutors will affect the timeline. The author of the timeline, Stephen Harper, a professor at Northwestern University and a regular contributor to The American Lawyer, joins us to discuss whether Mueller's secret and silent investigation, which Trump publicly and persistently trashes, is in the home stretch as the dots are being connected and the threads of investigations appear to be coming together. Then finally, we'll speak with a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations, David Freeman, the former head of the TVA, New York Power, the LADWP, and the State Energy Czar of California, who's the author of All Electric America, A Climate Solution and a Hopeful Future. He joins us to discuss Trump's peculiar affection for, quote, beautiful coal, and his hatred of what he calls windmills, as well as the need for environmentalists to get their act together and stop talking about climate change and start talking about climate damage. And joining us now, Jack Blum, a Washington lawyer who's an expert on white-collar financial crime and international tax evasion. He spent 14 years as a staff attorney with the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and has been a consultant to the United Nations Center on Transnational Corporations, the United Nations Office of Drug Control and Crime Prevention, and served as the chair of the Experts Group on International Asset Recovery. Currently, he serves as ADA counsel and is chair of Tax Justice Network USA and the Violence Policy Center. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jack Blum.
Thank you.
And Jack, since you've been involved in so many investigations over the years in Washington, in the Senate in particular, how did yesterday strike you, this 1-2 punch that Trump had to take with his campaign manager convicted on 8 counts and his personal lawyer and fixer copping a plea deal on 8 counts?
It was a pretty remarkable day. It's rare that investigators can put together with such precision what happened and go after the people involved and put it together as quickly as they did and as carefully as they did. So I'm very impressed with the investigation. I think it's as good as it gets. Now, on the tax part of the investigation, I'm talking now about Manafort. There were certain things that were there that are virtually impossible to defend against, and no reasonable jury could ever say the man is innocent. And that's where they control the foreign bank account, and they haven't bothered to tell IRS in the relevant form. They have to check the box, and the jury gets to look at the tax return. The box isn't checked, and the government simply shows that there's a bank account that the person controlled, in this case Manafort. So the counts involving control of offshore bank accounts are what we would call a slam dunk. The other counts are somewhat fuzzier, somewhat more difficult for juries to comprehend, but it's not really necessary for there to be conviction on all the counts. There's enough there, and there are enough counts that Manafort's been convicted on that we can count on him facing a long prison sentence and being forced to cooperate or receive a pardon.
But the fact of the matter is that the jury and the prosecutors were able to see Manafort's tax returns. None of us have seen President Trump's tax returns.
Obviously. And one suspects that the major reason for that is precisely the issue of control of offshore bank accounts. I think his tax returns would be sufficiently complex, and there are enough corporations involved and enough entities that trying to make a clean case for a jury based on Trump's taxes would be brutally difficult, unless they could say, well, here's the bank account you controlled, and here's where you didn't mention it on your tax return. But I don't think he'd have anything quite that simple or quite that naive.
So what I find extraordinary, though, Jack Blum, is that if you watch cable news, CNN and particularly MSNBC, particularly when the story broke in a split screen where you've got the Manafort trial on one side and the Michael Cohen plea on the other, almost happening simultaneously, that was a pretty giddy day for the press, but not for
it
Fox.
It certainly was.
But not for Fox News.
I watched Fox News this morning, and I was astounded at how they could blow off stuff that was this important, this obvious, and put a spin on it that made it appear as if what had happened was a non-event. And I still am stunned by it. It is now clear to me that the people who limit themselves to Fox News do in fact live in an alternative universe. And how people can do that with a straight face and call themselves journalists is a mystery to me.
Well, Fox is no longer reporting on Manafort and Cohen. I believe their main focus now is on the fact that the young woman who was murdered, was it in Iowa?
In Iowa. And they're trying to say that that's really the big story of the day, and please pay attention to that and ignore what happened in court in New York and in Alexandria, Virginia. And to me, that's totally shocking.
Right, but the spin on the Iowa murder is that the suspect is an undocumented immigrant, right?
Right, and this is both distraction and it's the ultimate in what he does so well, which is playing to the base. Any citizen who pays any attention, who looks at any other news, who has real sources of information and the ability to discriminate would immediately understand what a bunch of fools there are trying to persuade us that what happened in the court is unimportant. They'd know right away that approach is utter nonsense. And again, I just can't understand how a self-respecting journalist would be involved in that kind of chicanery.
Well, do you think, though, that as the law closes in on Trump from various directions, not just Manafort is facing another trial, but Cohen, who's essentially said he doesn't want a pardon and is going to cooperate with Mueller, and the plea from Cohen opens up the Avenatti, the guy that's representing Stormy Daniels, to probe what's going on, particularly with the tabloid king, David Pecker, who's got what he calls a favor bank full of the stories, the catch and kill stories that he did to cover up for Trump. That can of worms could be opened.
I'm sure it will be opened. And again, it'll be open to all of the folks who get news from multiple sources and are not, in effect, trapped by Fox and their alternative reality. And I think that this has to further erode Trump's support and really make him look like the incompetent idiot he is.
The man who said, I will get the best people. Now, just on the surface, you'd think that the fact that his campaign manager has been convicted, that his deputy his deputy campaign manager has been convicted, his national security advisor is making a deal, apparently, and has flipped. His foreign policy advisor has been convicted and was go to jail. And by the way, the first two members of Congress to support the Trump candidacy are both being indicted.
Right. And what I would say is that this man has surrounded himself on all sides with total sleaze. If you look at the conflicts of interest, Wilbur Ross has his failure to divest. If you look at some of the things his children have been doing, playing off the office of the president, this is a shocking situation. And what has happened is, and the analogy has been used, it's not original with me, it's like the lobster who's thrown in the pot and thinks he's going for a warm bath until the pot really starts boiling. And I think that's the way most of us have reacted to this news as it comes in incrementally. But if you step back and look at the totality of it, it is completely shocking.
And again, I'm speaking with Jack Blum, who's a Washington lawyer, who's an expert on white-collar financial crime and international tax evasion. He spent 14 years as a staff attorney with the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and has been a consultant to the United Nations Center on Transnational Corporations, the United Nations Office of Drug Control and Crime Prevention, and has served as the chair of the Experts Group on International Asset Recovery, and currently serves as ADA counsel and is chair of Tax Justice Network USA and the Violence Policy Center. And I forgot, by the way, in my list to mention that Wilbur Ross, you mentioned, he stole $120 million from a partner and had to settle before he joined the Trump administration. And, of course, one cabinet member was a wife beater, and another senior aide ended up being a wife beater. So,
And then there are the departed members of his cabinet who really covered themselves with inglorious moments.
Scott Pruitt.
There was the former secretary of HEW who went off. There was the business of private planes, extraordinary travel. We could bring up the head of EPA and all of the things he was doing, Pruitt. This is a truly remarkable situation. And at some point, this is all going to come together, at least for most of us who know how to read, and cause tremendous trouble for the administration.
So as bad as it is there in the swamp in Washington, and Trump, of course, cynically said he was going to drain the swamp, but he's done the opposite, and that's
his MO. Raised the water level.
He's raised the water level. But a whole new level of incredulity is out there in terms of what really is bubbling there in the back burner, and particularly within the confines of Robert Mueller's team, and that is what Trump refers to as collusion. No collusion, no collusion. Now, obviously, collusion is not a legal term, but conspiracy. There's so much evidence, and it gets bigger by the day, that this may end up being the hardest nut to crack and the hardest thing for people to get their heads around, not to mention those people in the Fox bubble who are impervious to facts and information. It looks like this guy, essentially, our president, could be controlled by a hostile foreign leader. A lot of people saw a glimpse of it in the press conference that followed the secret meeting between Putin and Trump in Helsinki.
Absolutely. And you come away from watching that press conference in complete shock. It's an impossible situation that a president of the United States would step out and talk about the wonderful offer he'd had from Vladimir Putin to have investigators go to Russia to talk to people in exchange for Putin having access to our former ambassador. Unbelievable. And he just came out there and brazenly said it. And I think even his own appointees, the ones who have some semblance of honor, were completely shocked.
Well, but I think he can make the case, and John Brennan did actually make the case, because when he was defending his use of the term, it was nothing short of treasonous. When he made the case, he actually made a case that Trump has committed treason, because Brennan, Comey, Clapper, and the head of the NSA all briefed Trump on January the 6th of 2017, a couple of weeks before he was inaugurated, and said, look, the Russians did it. And they gave him tons of evidence, most sophisticated, highly classified evidence there is, of what the Russian operation was about, their active measures campaign, and how much they influenced the campaign. And he's going after these very people. And then when in front of the eyes of the entire world at that press conference with Putin up in Helsinki, he was asked that question about Russian interference in the elections, and he basically took Putin's side.
Yes.
And that is treason, because a commander-in-chief, the president of the United States, who knows what happened, his job and his duty is to say, yes, Putin did do it, and looking him in the eye, saying, and he better not do it again. That's what a normal president would have done.
It certainly was a betrayal of interest and a betrayal of trust. Treason has a technical meaning. We're not, after all, at war with Russia. And it really is a performance that's completely unacceptable by any reasonable standard. But I'm a little reluctant to go to the point of saying it meets all the necessary legal tests for treason. What it does do is completely show how unfit for office he is and how dangerous this presidency has become.
But it does open up the question of what the Russians call kompromat. Because
yes,
watching him, the way he deferred to him, the body language, the submissiveness, a lot of people came to the conclusion that Putin must hold something over him. And
all you had to do was watch it, and that would be your first question. What has this guy got on Trump?
Well, that's an untenable situation.
It is, no question about it. So where are we headed becomes the next question. And I would argue that the likelihood is, with a change in Congress, we're headed toward impeachment.
But there are some rumors that in that secret meeting that Trump and Putin talked about Putin helping Trump out in the November elections, just as he did in the 2016 elections.
Mm-hmm.
Trump is terrified of impeachment. Putin allegedly, and I've heard this from intel sources, made the suggestion that he could help him out with cyber meddling and perhaps even take away the Democratic blue wave. And from Putin's point of view, if the elections are a complete disaster like they were in Florida 2000, writ large across the entire country, that plays into his playbook of demoralizing America and separating Americans from their democratic institutions.
I don't think that that would work a second time around, and it's a second time around that we're in. After all, what they did to convince various people to stay home and not vote, what they did to create fake rallies and meetings, all of that is pretty well exposed. And in fact, the various social networking systems have outed current attempts to do that to the electorate. So I think by now, the effectiveness of the technique will have gone down. Now, it may not have gone down with respect to the people who are Fox literate and nothing more, but I think that most people begin to understand that we're dealing with a man who's lied all the way and whose basic way of doing things is to distract every time another one of his very serious lapses is unearthed.
But if the Russians were able to disappear names from voting rolls, That's just one technique to cause chaos. They've done some probes along those lines.
I know, but I still would find it hard to believe that they could
be that brazen.
Seriously purge in a knowledgeable way voting rolls. The state secretaries of state have begun to really tighten that up. And for the most part, those voter systems are now completely off the Internet. So they operate without a basis for penetration. Now, also, to fix an election, you really have to do a lot of laundering of names and screwing around, because after all, there are so many local authorities involved in the election process that it's extremely hard to fix it.
Well, just in closing then, when you mention impeachment, how do you get from A to B? Nancy Pelosi saying that that is not on the agenda, impeachment. So how do you get people out to vote in sufficient numbers to take back the House and make impeachment possible? Because in the last midterm, only one-third of eligible Democrats showed up to vote.
Well, I think what happened on Tuesday afternoon will provide a lot of people with an incentive to go vote. I certainly hope so.
Well, Jack Blum, I thank you very much for joining us.
You're quite welcome. It's been a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Jack Blum, who's a Washington lawyer, who is an expert on white-collar financial crime and international tax evasion. He spent 14 years as a staff attorney with the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he has been a consultant to the United Nations Center on Transnational Corporations, the United Nations Office of Drug Control and Crime Prevention, and served as the chair of the Experts Group on International Asset Recovery, and currently he serves as the ADA Council and as chair of Tax Justice Network USA and the Violence Policy Center. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how yesterday's events will affect the comprehensive timeline of the Trump-Russia story. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Harper, a professor at Northwestern University and a regular contributor to The American Lawyer. He's the author of several books, including The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis, and Crossing Hoffa, A Teamster Story. And he blogs at The Belly of the Beast and has a comprehensive timeline of the Trump-Russia story at investigaterussia.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Harper.
Thank you, Ian. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, thank you, Stephen. And how much do you think the latest news with Mueller's conviction of Manafort and Cohen's guilty plea and his apparent cooperation with prosecutors, how much do you think it's going to affect your timeline?
That's a really good question. The last time you and I spoke, it was May 1st, and it feels like it was a lifetime ago because so much has happened. Ironically enough, I think it has a bigger impact on the public perception of what's going on than on anything that Mueller is or has been doing. You know, one of the things about an investigation, particularly with a person like Mueller, who's absolutely the highest quality person you could have doing this sort of a task, is, you know, we the public only know a small percentage, just a small tip of the iceberg, and so what we're now learning is probably stuff that he has known for a long time, certainly longer than we've known it. And I think that the import of the Manafort conviction is that it gives the lie to the claim that there's a witch hunt. And so now all you're going to see, and you'll continue to see, is is Trump trying to explain this away as, well, this doesn't really have anything to do, and I barely knew the guy, and who is Paul Manafort anyway? Never mind, I guess he was my campaign manager. But it validates the investigation. It deprives Trump of what I have always feared was a PR window that he would use in order to do something really drastic in terms of the Mueller investigation, like essentially trying to kill it. And that's what all his PR efforts have been over the last year and a half anyway, his constant attacks on the Department of Justice and the FBI and the shiny objects that he's waved. The Cohen thing, I think, is quite fascinating, and I think gives you a new wrinkle. It gives the timeline a new wrinkle for two reasons. One, it's extraordinary because there's nothing that Trump can do to stop what's happening in the Southern District of New York. That's not a Mueller case. That's brought by career prosecutors in Manhattan, and that case is moving forward. And now what we are learning, more it seems by the hour, from one of Cohen's attorneys, Lanny Davis. Lanny Davis has been hinting pretty clearly that Cohen is a person who is could be of great interest to Robert Mueller in the investigations that he has ongoing, and not the least of which is the report that came out a couple of weeks ago that at least suggested that Cohen knew or was able to testify that Trump had prior knowledge of the meetings in Trump Tower with Don Jr., Jared Kushner, Paul Manafort, and the Russians promising dirt on Hillary Clinton, which was a bombshell that's 2 or 3 weeks old, so by now everyone's already forgotten about it. I think it sort of remains to be seen, and we'll just have to see what Cohen has to say. But I think it'll have a pretty big impact going forward. I think it's a watershed. It ought to be a watershed kind of event for the people, the Republicans in Congress that have been, you know, completely complicit in allowing Trump to get away with the things that he's been doing and refusing to defend fundamental institutions of our democracy.
But how do you deal with Stephen Harper, the alternative universe in our media, where most of the media has headlines about the extraordinary revelations yesterday with the sentencing of Manafort and the guilty pleas of Cohen? Fox News has barely mentioned it, and all day today they've been beating the drum on Fox News about how a young woman in Iowa was allegedly murdered by an undocumented Mexican immigrant whose lawyers claim he is in the country legally.
Oh yeah, the woman in Iowa, right? That's the persistent problem. That's the persistent challenge to American democracy is the problem of you know, who gets their information from where, how reliable is it, is it even truthful? And we have somebody like Rudy Giuliani going on national airwaves on the talk shows on Sunday saying, you know, truth isn't truth. And you have Trump saying publicly, you know, what you see isn't what's actually happening. You know, you're living in 1984 in some respects. And there are people that are always going to be, I think, vulnerable to that sort of misinformation, this very systematic campaign of misinformation. It's nothing new. It's been happening for decades, you know, throughout civilization, and it's a very severe threat to freedom and democracy. And you only have to hope that there are enough of the rest of us, frankly, thanks to people like you, that are willing to you know, just try to keep the record straight. And that's the only reason that's the reason I do the timeline. I don't make any money doing the timeline. It's a question of just trying to get something out there that's reliable, accurate. There, I believe that most people, maybe I'm naive, but I believe that most people cherish American democracy enough to know what Thomas Jefferson knew, which is that a well-informed citizenry is the foundation of our democracy. And I continue to hope again that there are sufficient numbers of us that share that view, and that we are going to continue to be dedicated to determining the truth and making sure truth and facts and fact-based analysis is what happens. And the good thing, I think, about both the Cohen and the Manafort convictions is that I think what you see happening, there's nothing you can ever do about Fox News and whatever they choose to cover while every other news organization in the world is covering, you know, unbelievable developments in the presidency, and that will affect the presidency and the history of the United States for years to come. Nothing can do about that pocket, but I think it's of some significance that I think those sorts of events that happened yesterday do, I think, pierce through for at least many people much of the smoke and much of the cloud that Trump's chaos creates. And I have to believe that at some level, too, it's no accident that the GOP in Congress has been conspicuously silent about all of this. So if nothing else, it shuts them up. So
given the asymmetry between Mueller's secret and silent negotiation and Trump's everyday pounding away about a hoax and a witch hunt and no collusion as he publicly and persistently trashes the Mueller investigation, do you think that dynamic's changing?
I don't know if it's changing, but, you know, I think it's unfortunate that for the dignity of the office that Trump is, you know, tweets the way he does. But I think it's even more unfortunate for him, because these tweets are going to be extraordinarily incriminating as the continuing evidence of his obstruction emerges. It's already out there. I mean, I don't think it's hard for me to imagine that there are prosecutors who really, or even attorneys who seriously look at the situation and say, well, okay, there isn't any obstruction here relating to what the Mueller investigation is. But all of his tweets become part of a pattern that, at least to a capable trial lawyer, you can weave into a continuing story of a guy who is running scared, and in running scared, he says and does things that are incriminating. Tweets become, we are told from the very beginning, official statements of the White House. They're official statements of Trump. They become admissions that he cannot walk away from. So, you know, and he's obviously, they're playing a political game, but you know, at some point, there will be something that looks like a legal procedure that emerges from all of this, whether it's an impeachment proceeding and a trial in the Senate that results in his removal from office, followed then by actual criminal proceedings against him, which certainly could happen once he's no longer in office. All of these tweets become part of the record of his behavior and evidence that could ultimately come back, and I think will come back, and have in many ways already come back to really bite him in a bad way, as they did when he was tweeting about the travel ban initially on. You know, courts were citing the travel ban as evidence of what, you know, Trump was really intending, and that all those things come back to bite you, and I think that'll be true here as well. And all you can do, Mueller has no choice. Mueller can't speak, so it's up to the rest of us who can to speak for him in terms of the facts, and trying to get them out there and trying to get people to pay attention to them, because he's bound to remain silent. He'll remain silent. He'll have to remain silent, and he will.
But when you say, Stephen Harper, impeachment trial in the Senate, that would have to mean the Democrats take the Senate in November. They may be able to take the House. They're certainly hoping to. The Senate's a bit of an uphill climb. Do you think that Trump could do more damage? I mean, it looks as though he's angling, at least any signaling to Manafort, saying how brave Manafort is, to sort of hang in there, I'll pardon you.
Right.
Is that your reading on that?
It certainly looks like that, but you know, he did the same thing with Mike Flynn. You know, when Mike Flynn was in being questioned before he pled guilty, there were reports that Trump was getting messages to him that said things like "Stay strong," and it didn't have an effect. And I think, frankly, on the point of, you know, pardon, the question that I think somebody like Manafort has to begin to start asking himself is whether Trump has the political will to do that. You know, at this point, he's been saying, you know, it's old tax stuff, poor Paul Manafort, and that sort of thing. So he's, you know, he's giving kind of signals, but when the rubber meets the road, would he actually do it? I'm not sure, and I'm not sure Manafort can be 100% confident that that's what would happen either. On the other hand, I don't think it necessarily matters. I don't think Mueller's going to need Manafort in order to make his case, and so that's the other problem Trump faces. He's got so many wars now on so many fronts that there are claims, you know, even if you were to pardon Manafort, much of what Manafort has been convicted of and other things that he still stands accused of could be brought by state attorneys general, state prosecutors, which would not be, generally speaking, relieved by a presidential pardon of federal offenses.
Just in the last couple of minutes, given what we were talking earlier about people living in the Fox bubble, about a third of the population simply immune to facts and evidence, then what would permeate that? What would break through? Would it require Mueller to indict the son-in-law, Jared Kushner, or the son, Donald Jr.? What do you think it would get their attention that this is not a witch hunt, this is real?
Yes. Well, I think both of I think the Don Jr. indictment, I think, will happen, personally. And I think Roger Stone will be indicted. I think there are a whole series of really serious indictments that are going to come down the pike. And the answer to your question, I think, is the answer that on the day Richard Nixon resigned his office, he still had support, I should say, of 27% of the people. So the answer may be, you know, somewhere around 30 may be a floor that you can never penetrate. But you don't need to, because that means there's 70% that are going to just, you know, wheel him out, or somewhere between 60 and 70%. And the most important audience at this point, I think, is the congressional GOP. And they have to be nervous. You know, you start to see the polls closing in, and you start to see what's happening in states that should be easy wins and have been easy wins for Republicans for a long, long time. All of a sudden, the races are getting close. That has to give them great pause, I would think.
So you may never
penetrate that last 30%.
Right, right. But couldn't Trump deploy them as a kind of army?
Sure.
Coming to the rescue?
And he will. And I think that the most important thing about Trump is not to underestimate what he is willing to do to save his skin. He will throw everything under the bus, the Department of Justice, the FBI, everything. And whether it's a distraction or just something that he's just going to continue to do to try, you know, think of the analogy, I think, is a cornered, rabid animal. And that's what you're dealing with. And every biographer that you hear from or read who's written about Trump says that's what he is. That's who he is. And that's what he fears. And frankly, one of the things I think he fears a lot right now is a new book that I'm in the middle of reading that you might want to take a look at. It's remarkable. It's Craig Unger's book. He's a very well-respected journalist.
You know, I'm interviewing him tomorrow. Stephen,
fabulous.
We've run out of time, but I appreciate it very much.
My pleasure, Ian. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Harper, who's a professor at Northwestern University and a regular contributor to The American Lawyer. He's the author of several books, including The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis, and Crossing Hoffa, A Teamster's Story. And he blogs at The Belly of the Beast and has a comprehensive timeline of the Trump-Russia story up at investigaterussia.org. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing Trump's peculiar affection for what he calls beautiful coal and his hatred of what he calls windmills. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is David Freeman, a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He's had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under President Carter and also headed the New York Power and Los Angeles Department of Water and Power and was the state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from Enron and Company. Now a senior advisor to Friends of the Earth, he's the author of All Electric America, A Climate Solution and the Hopeful Future, and he has a new biography, The Green Cowboy. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Freeman.
It's always a pleasure, Ian.
Well, thanks, Dave. And this week, the Trump administration unveiled their replacement for the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan. And on Tuesday, President Trump went to sell this, or at least beat the drum on his new policy in a speech in West Virginia that was frankly bizarre, because he went on with his usual trashing of Hillary Clinton, and then he talked about how the people in West Virginia and Wyoming love what he's doing in Pennsylvania, and it's clean coal, I'm quoting, and it's clean coal, and we have the most modern procedures. Well, that's a total lie, but this is where it gets strange. But it is a tremendous form of energy in the sense that it's in a military way. Think of it. Coal is indestructible. You can blow up a pipeline. You can blow up the windmills. You know, the windmills, and he made these sounds like a windmill, they kill the birds, and they kill so many birds. And when the wind
just joined the Audubon Society.
Right. And then he went on to say, when the wind doesn't blow, what happens? When the wind doesn't blow, then we have a problem. I mean, it's hard to read what he says because it's all stream of consciousness. But why is he going after, and by the way, they're not windmills, they're wind turbines, but why is he going after wind energy?
Well, he's just going after the opposite of coal. You know, if you're a real strong human being, you don't fool around with this sissy-fied windmills and solar panels. You build big power plants and you burn coal. Come on, man, go with the program. I mean, that's his line. I mean, let me tell you, he knows how to appeal to his crowd. He takes one half of 1% of truth and covers it with 99.5% of lies, and he gets right into these people. We are dealing with a very skilled potential Hitler, and laughing at him is fun, but this is serious stuff. But there's one phrase that I don't think he's going to be uttering very much anymore. Remember how he used to love to say, lock them up? Well, that's exactly what we're doing, folks. We're locking them up.
Right. Well, what about the...
But let's get with the subject of energy. I mean, basically, what Trump has done is not... They've effectively repealed all the environmental laws. And I say that, you know, carefully, because my late father once taught me that if you didn't enforce a law, it just doesn't exist. And they're not enforcing the environmental laws. So I mean, the big headline is that he's come up with some baloney program and is not implementing Obama's so-called clean power program and blah, blah, blah. But the truth is much deeper and more frightening than that. They are not enforcing any of the laws that are on the books. And the tragedy here is not only what they're not doing about climate, which is a tragedy, but it's also there are over 50 localities in this country that are still violating the basic air quality laws. They don't meet the ozone standards. And the coal, with its particulate matter, is a principal source of what old-fashioned air pollution. People have sort of forgotten about that in the debate about climate, but it's still a problem in the cities. And the beautiful thing about electric cars and things like that is that it will not only alleviate climate damage, but it will enable kids to stop having asthma. And one of the criticisms I have of the so-called environmental movement, which is really not moving at all anymore, is that they don't emphasize the air pollution problem that all of America recognizes and together has been fighting all these years, which is so-called local air pollution, and combine that with the arguments about climate, which, of course, are more abstract and harder to sell. But in any event, we're witnessing something far worse than some baloney out of Trump's mouth. I mean, and now we at least, the one thing about Scott Pruitt is that he called attention to what he was doing, because he did so many completely stupid things that people paid attention to the really bad things that he were doing, But now you got an administrator over there that is not stealing for himself. He's just stealing from Mother Nature and stealing from all of us by not enforcing the environmental laws. And there is no outrage.
Dave, I think you can fault the press here, because the response to Trump's getting rid of Obama's clean power plant in all of the newspapers and TV coverage has been stressing that this reversal and bringing back coal-fired plants will kill 1,400 more people per year. But what you're telling us is this is a much bigger picture than killing 1,400 more people.
Yeah, if you read the articles carefully, there's a sentence or two in which they are defensive by saying that the benefits to local air pollution of the Clean Power Program will be implemented because we have other means of enforcing the basic air quality law. They sure the hell do. It's called the National Air Pollution Control Act, but they're not enforcing it. The papers don't, the media, they don't talk about that. And, it's what they're not doing that is the big deal. What they are doing is bad, but what we're not doing in terms of just plain old air quality and, more importantly, on the issue of climate. By the way, I want to enlist you in pain. I am now trying to get every media in the country to stop using the words climate change and use the words climate damage. That's the least we can do, is start calling it what it is. I mean, most people, you tell them, call it climate change, and it's vague, and a lot of people will say, well, the climate changes all the damn time. What the hell are you talking about? But we now have enough evidence that it's climate damage that we're talking about. And I think it would help a tiny bit if we started using those words. So the one thing Trump has kind of demonstrated is that plain English can be a hell of a lot more effective than vague comments that are technically accurate.
And again, I'm speaking with David Freeman, a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He has had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under President Carter and also headed New York Power and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was the state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from Enron and Company. Now a senior advisor to Friends of the Earth, he's the author of All Electric America, A Climate Solution and the Hopeful Future. And he has a new autobiography, The Green Cowboy. So when you said a minute ago, Dave Freeman, that when you talked about the environmental movement, that it's not a movement because it's not moving, what's the problem here? Why?
Well, here's the problem. When it comes to health care, I think the progressive Democrats have kind of coalescing about the idea of Medicare for all. We have a goal. It's pretty clear. You can say it in one sentence. People can understand it. And it's gaining traction. Correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
When it comes to climate, what is the progressive Democratic legislative proposal on climate?
Well, are you getting
you get a yawn, or they walk away from you, it's not there. With all due respect, and I admire California. I spent 20 years though there, and they're probably the leader in the world in what they're doing. But the greenhouse gases are not going down. I mean, with all due respect, Mother Nature isn't hearing those speeches, and Mother Nature doesn't really much care about cap and trade, because that's just kind of making people pay to pollute, and the money is used for a matter of good cause. But look at the numbers. Total greenhouse gases are not going down. The climatologists tell us they got to go down starting yesterday, at least 3% a year to get down to zero, you know, in time to avoid what would be catastrophe. We got climate damage already. The question is, how much are we going to get? And I don't, you know, I admired Governor Brown. I mean, he can leave office being very proud that California has a law in the books to go to 50% renewable for the electric power sector, and that's an accomplishment. But two-thirds of the greenhouse gases come from the oil and gas in transportation and heating and industry. And we don't have any effective programs, even in California, that are reducing that. I mean, it's good to say we want a million electric cars, and I love all the speeches. But under Duke Machen, 15 years ago, we had mandates to make Detroit have a higher and higher percentage of zero-emission cars. We don't have such a law on the books in California today. And so my words go out to Gavin Newsom. He has a real opportunity to start doing some things that are going to get the total greenhouse gases down. I mean, I hate to say this, but the words clean coal came out of Barack Obama's mouth the first year he was president. His policy was all of the above. How in the name of common sense can we eliminate greenhouse gases if the national policy is all of the above? So we Democrats, you know, we're entitled to criticize Trump, and I just did. But you don't win a ball game on defense. What's our offense? Mother Nature is looking for it. And Kevin DeLeon is trying hard to get a bill to go to 100% renewables. Whether he can get it passed or not remains to be seen. But that will just clean up the electric sector. We need mandates to require that the cars become more and more zero electricity, and we need to get the utilities and other people to finance the retrofitting of homes to get off of natural gas and get onto heat pumps and using that clean renewable energy for heating and other purposes. We got to get down to zero. And it's way too late for pilot programs, you know. And the problem is that when I talk to young people, it's hard to get them to have a sense of urgency. I'm 92, but on the issue of climate, folks, we're all 92. And if we don't realize that and act like we're 92 with a very little time left, you know, we're letting our kids down in a very, very fundamental way, even more so than all the money we're borrowing.
So when you say we should no longer use the word climate change, we should use climate damage, I think that's a very, very powerful and useful message. And I hope that the resistance or the Democrats or whatever you want to call it, borrow.
And I will be listening to you, Ian.
Yeah, well, I'll do what I can. But I'm unfortunately a fairly minor voice in the broadcast spectrum. But what about, though, when you talk about the Democrats not having a platform, and when you asked that question, there was a silence because I haven't heard anything from them about dealing with this issue. Apparently what they're thinking about as a winning issue is just the general corruption, because this Trump administration is so manifestly corrupt and it's so obvious that every day we learn more about corruption. And it turns out the first two Congress people to support Trump have both been indicted. So that's just another window. And, of course, all these other characters surrounding him, all of his, just about everybody is either indicted or about to be arrested. So Elizabeth Warren wants to make this a centerpiece. Can you tie corruption into what you were saying early about the EPA, how they're not doing their job because obviously they're being paid off by industry?
Well, the most fundamental form of corruption imaginable would be to burn up the only home we have. I mean, if somebody came along and set fire to every home in America, that's a pretty corrupt practice, I would say. I mean, you don't need to stretch it. If you really believe the scientists, You don't need to reach out for some excuse. I mean, let me just be blunt. We have history to tell us. We elected a man on the basis of cleaning things up, and he did a great job in that sense, Barack Obama. But he did not have a climate platform worth fighting for. He chose to fight for health care, and God bless him, that was an important victory. But quite frankly, we're not going to have any health if we don't have a home to live in. And we lost 8 years, and especially the first few years, because we did not have a single bill or a piece of legislation to fight for that would get the job done. We were fooling around with the leftover of George Bush's market-oriented cap-and-trade system, and then that didn't pass because there wasn't that much passion behind it. Now, with 2020 coming up, I'd say it's our last clear chance. And I'm not a fool. We can't win the election on the issue of climate change. But unless the so-called environmental movement doesn't get together and draft a piece of legislation that is passable, that is part of the platform, that the new president is committed to making a high-priority item, it ain't going to happen. Let me tell you, I don't want to criticize anybody that's taking some lead now, but the major bill on climate, the 100% renewable bill, is 320 pages long and full of all kind of subsidy programs that are no longer necessary. The environmental movement is out of touch with the environment. I mean, they're still making the arguments that make it sound like it's a sacrifice to go to 100% renewable. And that the issue is something that you just got to believe in what Al Gore says. No, there's unmistakable evidence now, but the thing that's really changed is that the modern-day Edisons have invented solar, wind, and storage technologies that are cheaper than the dirty stuff. And we're not out there saying that the insurance policy against climate damage is not only not costly, it pays dividends. Why aren't we making that argument? Why don't we have a bill to mandate this transition 3% a year across the board, just like we're doing in the electric power industry? I mean, and, you know, I'm not the only one that can think of things like this. It's just that there's this sorry, lazy attitude that if it can't pass Congress today, it's not worth fooling with. And with that attitude, you know, we're goners on climate.
Well, David Freeman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yeah, but I want to end up by saying I'm an optimist because I think that the technological breakthrough, we just need one really good female version of Ralph Nader to lead us, that's all.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, and I thank you for joining us, David Freeman.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with David Freeman, a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He's had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under President Carter and also headed New York Power and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power and was the state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from Enron and Company. Now a senior advisor to Friends of the Earth, he's the author of All Electric America, A Climate Solution and the Hopeful Future. And he has a new autobiography, The Green Cowboy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.